Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. It's your future. Let Zurich help you protect it. Talk to us today about life and serious illness cover.
Carl, thank you very much for that. Now, Valerie French Kilroy was murdered by her husband, James Kilroy, in June 2019. Kilroy was given the mandatory sentence of life in prison this week after being found guilty last week of murder. He had claimed he was insane and suffering from cannabis-induced psychosis, or a form of acute and transient psychotic disorder. Mr. Justice Tony Hunt said Kilroy's actions had caused enormous and permanent damage, and the fallout from the night he killed his wife would continue for years to come. Valerie's family are now arguing that there's a loophole in legislation which allows murderers to retain their parental rights, and this law, they say, should be changed, as it already has been in the UK. Just before coming on air, I spoke to Valerie's brother, David French, in studio, and I first asked him to tell me a little bit about his sister.
Valerie, my sister, second youngest of five. Born in 77, grew up on a farm, back of Lepp, West Cork, on the way to Skibbereen. Great fun, caring, capable, quite artistic. Career guidance in secondary school pointed her towards occupational therapy, and the best place to do that at the time was Cardiff. That whole job and profession is about mostly helping people overcome difficulties, get on with their life. And she was kind of doing that anyway, always, whether it was work or home or wherever, that was just her nature. Mostly turn her hand at anything, gardening, Airbnb, dealing with people, lifting spirits. Good at her job, enjoyed life, loved being a mother, and she was the main breadwinner for her family.
And where did you come in the family?
So eldest and only son.
Okay, so she was your little sister.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Can you tell me where you were and what happened and how you heard of what happened?
I was actually reading bedtime stories to my kids, and one of my other sisters rang, and it was strange, you know. It was like the guards are at Mum's house telling us, you know, to tell Mum Valerie's dead. Thankfully, my sister was actually visiting Mum that time. And, you know, I got onto the guards via the phone. They couldn't tell us much at the time. It was really more about what they couldn't tell us, but they were kind of clear Valerie was dead. And, you know, it was at the home place. It kind of all went off from there. You know, I drove across from where I live in Wicklow. I was dealing with the Gardaí in Castlebar. And so dealing with them, identifying Valerie's body, being in Castlebar court for the murder charge. Valerie had been at my house for my son's birthday party the previous weekend. So it was very, very unreal. It was just, you know, like, wow, yeah.
I can't even imagine you're there reading your children bedtime stories and you get a phone call like that. What ran through your mind?
It was like, is this wrong? Is it not Valerie? Is this a mistake? And then it's like, well, if they're sure it's Valerie and they're sure she's dead, like you kind of think, well, maybe it was an accident. Maybe she banged her head off the mantelpiece or, you know, something like that. You don't start at murder. Obviously, your first thought is some horrible accident. You couldn't exactly imagine why. You know, if it was on the road, you think it was a car accident. That was probably my first thought. It was a car accident, but, you know, it wasn't that.
And you say you'd seen her just the week before. What sort of form was she in?
She was in good form. I mean, it was my son's birthday party. She had her kids with her. We were doing all the usual kids' birthday party kind of stuff, walking, you know, going out walking the dog. We went for a walk up in the woods back in my house, throwing pine cones around the place. She was in good form. She had a bunch of things she wanted to buy for the garden. She was visiting one of my other sisters as well. In good form. I mean, she, you know, in retrospect, we've had 5 years to look back. Mm. She said stuff that I'd kind of be reinterpreting now. It's like, oh, is that what she meant? Is that what she meant? Whatever. But there was nothing jumped out.
And this is what I was wondering. Did she have any idea that there were problems or that there was anything of this nature going on or coming down the road at all?
It's basically no. Like, we didn't kind of be, we weren't thinking, oh, we're terribly worried about Valerie. It wasn't, there weren't things at that stage. I mean, you know, family obviously super busy minding 3 kids, so no particular worries, certainly nothing in this direction.
You said in your victim impact statement that Valerie's murder was violent and prolonged and that she died in terror for her own life and the lives of her children. Can you tell me, what did you mean by that?
So the post-mortem with its 56 or 57 injuries got the violent stuff, that's cleared. It was clearly a prolonged attack. Again, this is straight from the post-mortem, multiple injuries, all of that kind of stuff. It was clearly a struggle that moved from one place to another. There was multiple weapons involved. you know, you can see it in the postmortem stuff. It was grim, to use one of Valerie's words. The children were at the house when she left. She either put them to bed or left them to be put to bed. She knows what's going on. So the immediate thought would be, well, have they already been attacked? Are they going to be attacked? What's going on? Like, so her thought was for them. And like, in my head, I think, well, if someone attacked you, you try and run away.
Mm.
But you won't run away if your kids are in the house.
So you think she stayed because she wanted to protect the kids because they were upstairs?
Well, it was a bungalow, so they weren't technically upstairs. But if she had a chance to run and no one knows where she did or not, then, I mean, she certainly had a choice of walking towards her attacker or walking into the house. Then she made the choice that would protect them. So, you know, it's very hard to, I don't know of any crime reconstruction thing or anything like that. That's just my take on the facts that we know at the time.
Of course, as you said, it was your mother who received the initial phone call from the guards, and every mother's worst nightmare to get a call like that. How did she manage and how did she take the news?
It was almost impossible for mom to process. She was asking questions of like, you know, where, like, obviously, where is he? And that was something the guards couldn't talk about. For a long time, mom was worried about, well, till for the rest of her life, she was obviously worried about the fate of the children. But she was also concerned about the effect on us. She was just completely knocked us under. I mean, when things came out about an earlier psychotic disorder that the murderer had, her thoughts were, well, why didn't they tell us? Like, why was this concealed? And now we find it out, maybe something could have been done. She was blown away by that kind of perpetrator approach of almost trying to compromise us and draw us into like, oh, it's all a joint family tragedy. We know now, 5 years later, no, it's a murder. It's not like a car crash where one parent survived. This is a completely different thing.
Your mother died a short time after Valerie died.
Mum passed away in November. Mum was also called Valerie. And the death was sudden. I mean, she was in perfect health, you know, visited her doctor, all grand. She was living alone, drove her car, you know, social life, all the rest of it. And yeah, suddenly she gets a stroke and she did survive a few days after that, but, you know, didn't regain consciousness and died. In advance of that, like she had said, you know, she said multiple things, you know, our family is destroyed, my life is ruined. And my mum wasn't someone for big statements. You know, she's a very, very calm person. She really could never get over it. It just knocked her for six. And all the complexity that lands afterwards, you know.
I'm so sorry for the loss, both obviously of your mother and of the younger Valerie. How is the rest of the family coping?
Quite well, thanks. Given circumstances, what jumps out is that people process stuff in different ways and at different speeds. And it's not a journey towards something getting better. It's just a journey along. Like, you know, it'll never get better. You just get used to it. But people do it at different speeds.
And I hear a lot of people describing grief like that. It doesn't go away.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you grow around it.
It's just a different place.
So all of that happened 5 years ago now, or certainly Valerie's murder happened 5 years ago. What has happened since then?
So, mum dying suddenly a few months later. The aftermath then of these two deaths is two inquests. There was actually an inquest into mum's death as well, partly because it was so sudden. So we had two inquests in 2020. Criminal trial was supposed to be 2021. There is loads of, you know, go into court and find out what's going on next with the trial, how it's progressing. So many, many days of going into court, find out what's going on. We eventually got a trial date for March 23. And of course, all this lockdown happens and COVID happens, all that stuff, you know, and it happens and goes away. March 2023, we go in for a trial, you know, all hyped up for a trial. Then it collapses. It gets rescheduled for November 23. It starts, it runs till almost the last day. And then it collapses. And then we get rescheduled for June. And suddenly that June becomes July. And, well, here we are. That's 5 years and 5 minutes.
It's so difficult. I can only imagine for everybody involved the lengthening of that process. During all that time, where was Valerie's husband?
He was always remanded to Castlereagh Prison. So he was always there except for, you know, court appearances or whatever. So the court appearances for the criminal trial and also for his role as guardian of the children.
And I know that's one of the things that you really want to speak to us about today, David, is that he has automatic guardianship of the children, even now after his conviction for Valerie's murder. Is that right?
Absolutely. The conviction for murder is kind of neither here nor there. I mean, as her husband, when the children were born, he's the guardian. The conviction, like the apprehension, the murder charge conviction, it's got nothing to do with the guardianship. It makes no difference.
In May of this year, the UK government brought in what's known as Jade's Law, and that ensures that a parent who is convicted of killing the other parent doesn't retain guardianship of the surviving children. And that is really what you and your family are looking for here, that sort of legislation.
Absolutely. In a nutshell, yes. It is actually really that simple. That sentence in law, you know, ideally retrospectively, but to make sure that this doesn't happen to other children going forward. And we know, you know, there's been 10 women killed every year for the last 20 years. It's like they're typically of childbearing age. So there's typically children involved. There's a whole bunch of children. I've met a bunch of them in the same situation. Our situation is far from unique, sadly, but this is something that recurs every year.
You made a very harrowing point, really, outside the criminal court. You said killing a mother is child abuse and children need to be protected from abusers. And I suppose that's another way of saying what you've said to me today, another way of seeing it.
It is, and I think it should almost be the central way. Like, in this country in particular, we hear child abuse and our mind goes straight into the gutter. Mm. Like, we straight away think it's sexual abuse. Like, there are other ways of abusing people. And killing someone's mother is an abusive thing to do. Killing either parent is an abusive thing to do, but killing their mother is, like, I don't think anyone could argue that's not child abuse.
Can you just talk me through the different political support that you might have and where it's at?
So, I've been in contact with Holly for this, about this issue for some time. I mean, she started on the necessary drafting, and that's great. Like, we're really grateful for Holly's support on this. And I really hope this is something that, you know, she can rapidly get before the Dáil. That would absolutely be great. And, you know, from my simplistic viewpoint, it's a small piece of legislation. It doesn't have to go in with a ton of other things. It's like, literally, it's one line. And, like, you might think, why Holly Cairns? I mean, you know, I mentioned LEP. So it's West Cork. Holly's one of our local TDs. Now, Christopher O'Sullivan, different party, also a local TD. He's been in contact on this and really appreciated that. I know Michael Collins, independent, he has very strong views on this. So, you know, it's sort of, this is not a party political issue. I mean, I've heard Micheál Martin, Simon Harris, Roderick O'Gorman, Mary Lou MacDonald, all express strong views on the issue of men's violence against women. Mm. It's, you know, no problem. They've all said the right things and they all want to see this progress.
So your hope obviously would be that there will be cross-party political support for this. Have you spoken to the Minister for Justice or have you sought a meeting with her?
First of all, the justice system that the Minister is in charge of, or her department is in charge of, has just delivered absolutely the right verdict. The justice system is only one part of Minister McEntee's wide responsibilities. I've heard the minister speak at multiple Women's Aid events, in person, on video. Like, she is totally committed to this area. I would ask her to have the department fast track this particular recommendation.
And when you say fast track, I suppose because we are talking about a limited number of years here for the children. It's not just the children in this particular case and that are involved. As you say, there's many cases like this around the country. So there's an urgency as you see it.
There is an urgency. I mean, the situation recurs over and over again. Children doesn't go out forever. It's already a slow process and there's a gap between a crime and a conviction. It's needed to kind of move along with these things, and especially, you know, when it's not a very complicated thing and when there's not a whole different set of other sides on it.
And this is something you think Valerie would have wanted?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to me then about Valerie, just as we're here, and I know it's been a very big and another difficult week for your family?
I guess, like, what needs saying about Valerie is, like, if I was in the grave, she'd be the one here doing this.
That's the way you see it. You're fighting for her.
Absolutely.
And for what she would have wanted.
Yeah. I mean, that's what she'd have wanted. If her last words, if we were to believe the perpetrator, then her last words were, what about the boys? And that is the question.
David French, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And that was David French, brother of Valerie French Kilroy, speaking to me a little earlier. We did ask the Department of Justice for a statement, and here is what they said. The study on familicide and domestic and family violence death reviews was commissioned by the Department of Justice and involved an independent study lead who consulted with a wide range of stakeholders. The review was brought to government and published in May 2023. A significant number of the recommendations made in the review are already being progressed as part of the work to tackle domestic abuse and protect victims. A new team has been established in the Department of Justice to review the other recommendations made in the review. These include a recommendation on restricting parental rights in cases of domestic homicide. In the case of this recommendation, the issues to be considered include the role and power to TUSLA to take appropriate child protection action in emergency situations, the importance of putting the rights and voice of the child at the centre of our responses, and ensuring that nothing is done that could prejudice a trial. And that statement just in from the Department of Justice.